Physics World.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Physics World Weekly. I'm James Dacey, and I'm currently enjoying the sun in Croatia on my summer holiday, hopefully being greeted with smiles and complimentary drinks as the nation still basks in the glory of beating England at the World Cup. But last week, I recorded a couple of interviews on two very different topics. A little later, you'll hear from Daniel Jopling, my colleague here at IOP Publishing. Dan's been busy recently launching three new open access journals in the fields of energy, photonics, and materials. I spoke to him about the vision for these journals and how they connect with the wider movement of open science. First though, I popped up to the engineering department at the University of Bristol. I met with Bruce Drinkwater, whose research involves using ultrasound to investigate material structures without damaging them. I began by asking Bruce what ultrasound is and why he's so fascinated by it.
So yeah, ultrasound is sound waves above a frequency that we can hear as humans. So we can hear up to about 20 kilohertz. So any sound waves beyond 20 kilohertz classify as ultrasound. It's interesting, I suppose, because all sorts of reasons, but as the frequency goes up, the wavelength goes down, and that means you can see smaller and smaller objects. Also, I suppose it means you can use the sound waves, and humans aren't disturbed by them, by ultrasounds. If you can map out the geometry of a room if you wanted to with ultrasound, and no one would hear anything, which would be quite convenient. But on the other hand, if you're trying to do imaging either on the medical side or on the crack detection side, so non-destructive testing, then getting wavelengths down to millimeter order, that's the sort of size of object you might want to, the sort of size of crack or the size of object you might want to see within the human body. In order to do that, you have to take the frequency up. So you have to go up to megahertz, millions of cycles per second, which is well into the ultrasonic regime. So I guess they're the things that ultrasound brings to the table.
So we're sitting here in your office in the engineering department building. So, I mean, would you say the type of work you engage in, is it physics or is it engineering or is it some kind of hybrid of the two?
It's a good question. I mean, I trained as an engineer and I'm in an engineering department, but a lot of what I publish ends up going into physics journals. I work with physicists and engineers, and I don't tend to see much of a distinction. So to some extent, I guess there's a sort of a blurry boundary between the two subjects. And I, you know, in a sense, as the world goes forward, some of these pigeonholes, you know, you're an engineer, you're a physicist, you know, are maybe not that helpful. But yeah, I think I'm a bit of both. There's a sort of maybe some people think that, and I suppose it's right, that there's a bit of a mindset difference. An engineer is always trying to do something that's useful, that's going to be a product that's out there and used, and that's a kind of classic idea of what an engineer is. And on the other side, a physicist might be just trying to understand purely a phenomena. But equally, I'd say there are plenty of physicists that are trying to use their physics to do something that becomes a useful product, and there are plenty of engineers that don't really care about the end use of what they're doing. I'm somewhere between the two, in it, as much as that, you know, part of me really cares about doing something useful and making products and doing research that feeds into those products, but another part of me just wants to understand exactly why things are as they are. And I think those two things go kind of quite nicely together. If you understand something properly, at a kind of a deep level, think like a physicist, then it's that understanding that leads you to making better products or making better measurements.
Well, I suppose it must, you know, over the course of a career, it must keep you excited in the actual research you're doing. If you're genuinely fascinated with understanding how it works, I guess that gives you the passion to continue.
Yeah, I think, like, exactly, it keeps life interesting. It's important that life's interesting, I think, if you're a researcher, always looking for new things. But I think that it's that understanding, that deep understanding, which is perhaps what you might think of as what a physicist would do, that leads you to do good engineering. So I think the two things fit together. So I guess I'm an engineer and an applied physicist, both of them together.
So I guess, yeah, so an example of
those two functions of the job is this work you do in looking at how structures fail. So I guess it's developing an understanding of the sort of fundamental science of how that happens, and then applying that to industries such as looking at aircraft and how they could potentially fail. So I mean, do you want to maybe say a bit about how that process works, you know, how your work kind of feeds into that sort of safety mechanism in the industry?
Yeah, so I suppose, I mean, so I use ultrasound, which is a form of mechanical wave, and those waves can travel in gases, liquids and solids. And so in terms of looking at how structures fail, that's generally putting those sound waves into solid structures and looking at how those ultrasonic waves are reflected from the interior of the structure. So, you know, the thing that people often have in their mind when they think about this subject is detecting cracks, and they are ultimately how things, big pieces of metal, fail by cracking. You know, that's kind of how they fail. So detecting cracks is a really important part of that whole field called non-destructive testing. So you're trying to test something without destroying it, and ultrasound is a great tool for doing that. But of course, you'd like to understand how your structure fails at the earliest possible time. So that means detecting really, really very small cracks. So that's, you know, sub-millimeter cracks within really thick metallic structures. And those metallic structures are not as easy to get sound into as you might have thought. But they've got lots of other things in there. In particular, they've got a grain structure, which is the sort of their little crystals within there, essentially. And when you go from one crystal boundary to another, you get a reflection. So it means, as well as there being signals that the ultrasound being reflected back off cracks and defects and corrosion, whatever the defects might be, you also get this backscattered stuff from the interior of the structure. So it's a really, what I'm trying to paint a picture of is it's quite a challenging area.
Yeah, yeah. So would you, you know, in the case of analysing a structure, a metallic structure, would you use your ultrasound technique in combination with, you know, a range of other things, which obviously would start with just having a look at the structure itself from the outside, but is there a whole spectrum of other techniques that are working alongside this?
Yeah, the general field of non-destructive testing is you test it any way you can. You've got to use any form of physical phenomena that might solve the problem. So, you know, X-rays are a classic technique. Also, looking at how electromagnetic waves interact with structures, or heat, how heat is distributed within a structure, as well as ultrasound. These are, and there are many more. So, I mean, people aren't proud of whatever technique you can use if it gives you a chance of measuring a structure and how it's changing over time, then people will be using it. The thing you've got to imagine is that all structures like aircraft, power stations, bridges, as time goes on, they age and they start to fail. It's a natural thing, just like humans age. Engineering structures age, and so people don't like the idea that their aircraft are aging and possibly starting to fall apart, but that's reality, and the job of this field is to try and catch that and monitor that, so find the way in which the structures are failing at the earliest possible time, and then to track that throughout the life and ensure that things are safe.
So it sort of provides you with a predictive power as well. If you can understand, you can develop a model of how structures fail, you can identify the moment when perhaps it's approaching a critical point.
Yep, exactly. I mean, what people want to know the answer to, which is a very hard thing to answer, is what is the remaining life of my structure? And so that's, we try to get as close to that as we possibly can. But yeah, that's the key thing. I suppose as a human, you don't really want to know how long you've got to live. But you do with a structure. You'd like to know how long that structure's got to live before it fails. I mean, the other thing is that with a structure, because it's been designed by humans, we have got the opportunity to make it fail in a safer way as possible. So you might build in you over design it in a way that if one component fails, then for example a load might be shifted to another component, and the whole thing remains safe.
So I mean, you mentioned sort of applications there in industry, you know, people developing new machinery, new equipment. I mean, is it also applied to other fields, though, things like archaeological structures and artworks? And would it ever be applied to that sort of thing as well?
Absolutely. I mean, so this field of non-destructive testing is a kind of a measurement science, and so we're making measurements of the state of structures. So the same techniques that you might use to look at whether a component in an aircraft has got cracks in it or whether it's aging in some other way, you could use those exact same techniques to look at a work of art to see if that's failing, a fresco on the wall of a chapel or something. You know, is the material coming away from the wall or isn't it? Mm-hmm. Those sorts of questions could be addressed by the same sort of technology. And of course, X-rays are used widely, mm-hmm. both in medicine, mm-hmm. in looking at archaeological remains, and for looking at whatever we want, welds in a nuclear power station. Mm. You know, the techniques are kind of shared across these fields. So it's quite a wide field in that sense, and I think that's one of the things that kind of has always appealed to me about it. It's a field that's I always think of it a bit like an iceberg, where the general public, I think, don't have an idea about that little tip of the iceberg of the field that mm-hmm. where they might encounter it. But actually, it's a huge field. You know, pretty much every engineering structure and of course in medicine as well, is there's this whole trying to measure the remaining the condition of structures.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose looking to the future as well, are there any applications that, you know, you've always dreamt of applying this technique to, but have sort of evaded you up to this point?
That's a good question. I suppose I'm not sure I necessarily think of it like that. I think of the challenges that remain. So, I mean, I said earlier that people really want to know the remaining life of their structure, and that's something that we can't really answer yet at the moment. We can give some information about the state of the structure, you know, the remaining thickness of the material, how long, and the geometry. We're trying to get as close to understanding how the geometry of any cracking, so how long is the crack, what angle is the crack at, is it a branched crack, that sort of information. We're quite close to, we're striving to get more and more accurate information about those things. But that's not quite enough to tell you the remaining life of the structure. Mm. You have to make a whole load of then other assumptions about how it fails in order to get to that point. So that's something I think is very, very important, a kind of important unsolved problem. I mean, another thing that's of huge interest to this field is the idea of basically structures having more and more sensors attached to them. And I think it's a trend that the industry is interested in, and I'm interested in as well, in that at the moment a lot of these measurements are done by humans being deployed up scaffolding or dropping down a rope on a oil rig and making a measurement under really, really tough conditions. And so it's hard to make good measurements, you know, very hard. You can imagine, you know, the measurements we might make in our lab, trying to transport those to somebody dangling off a rope in the North Sea on the leg of an oil platform.
Yeah.
But so we really want to try and make those measurements all automated, and that means integrating the sensors and the measurement systems into the structure. But you know, that's easier said than done, and there's then a question of what data should we get? Where should the sensors go, and then what should we do with all that data? And so I think this is another interesting trend that people are putting more and more sensors on their structures, getting more information about different aspects of the health of the structure. But how do we use that data to the best effect? So it's the field of data analytics and data science.
I mean, is that connected with, you know, you hear a hell of a lot in the media, I suppose, these days about developments in, you know, the Internet of Things, so better connectivity and also, you know, virtual reality, where you can sort of perhaps look inside and visualise these structures, and then also artificial intelligence. I mean, there's obviously lots of different things there, but are these kind of general trends then? potentially helping your field as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're not there yet. And there are some cases where good progress is being made, but it feels like there's some really interesting work out there that's that needs to be done to make all this happen. And that work will require researchers, so academics like myself, to work in quite close collaboration with industry, because these challenges are challenges that are applied to big structures. And you know, I can build some small structures in my lab, but I can't really recreate an aircraft or a an oil drilling platform or a petrochemical plant or a power station too easily. So in order to make any progress on those things, I have to be, and I do try to collaborate with the people who run those sorts of big engineering entities.
Bruce then took me to the lab to show me one of the ultrasound experiments.
Okay, so we're in the ultrasonics lab now, and we've just sat down at a computer monitor where we can see an image on the screen here. And this image has been generated by an array. It looks like a sort of a block of metal, really, but it's a little box that's got in it 64 tiny little emitters of ultrasound. It's all clamped to a piece of metal here, so what's going on in the background, you might just about be able to hear the hum of the instrument, is we're collecting a load of data from this particular sample here. So the ultrasonic, so each of these little emitters is firing out some ultrasound. It's going into the, interacting with the interior of this block of metal, and then the signals are kind of coming back and being picked up by all these other, little sensors. So we've got a little, making a lot of ultrasonic measurements of this structure, and we're using that all those collected echoes to form an image. It isn't the world's most interesting image at the moment because the structure is just a fresh block of metal. There shouldn't be anything wrong with it, and we can see that there isn't anything wrong with it on the screen. What we're trying to do here, though, is not just form images, but try to say something about the state of the structure, the remaining life of the structure. And to do that, we're going to measure these tiny nonlinearities of the structure. So what we're going to try and what we're trying to measure here are tiny nonlinearities in the structure. And what that means for us here is we're going to look at the distortion of these ultrasonic waves. So we send in a wave, and in this case we're sending in a 5 megahertz signal here, and we're looking to see whether the reflected signals are 5 megahertz, so that's the frequency, or whether they've been distorted, so whether the energy has been shifted to other frequencies. And that energy shift happens as a result of material aging. We're charting how the energy is moving away from the driving frequency. And the hope of these measurements is that we can find this relationship between the nonlinearity of the structure and the remaining life of the structure. These nonlinearities, though, are incredibly small. They're like 1 part in 1,000 or 1 part in 10,000. So they're very hard to make. And one of the big challenges that we're trying to solve is we can just about make these measurements under ideal laboratory conditions, which is kind of what you're seeing before you. But can we make these measurements in a reliable enough way that you might be able to make the same measurements on a pressure vessel in a factory somewhere and determine its remaining age? So that's the kind of challenge that we're trying to address.
I mean, in the setup here, you have the strip of metal, and it's obviously clamped, and it's probably about 5-6 centimeters across. What is the length scale that you can actually use with this technique? I mean, if you were in a factory setting and you were trying to measure a significantly bigger structure, perhaps several meters across, is that beyond the range of this technique?
So the relevant dimension on it is this one here, which is about 50 millimeters, which I would think of as the kind of the thickness of the metal structure. And actually, this is a very typical thickness of pressure vessels in the power generation industry. So you do get some that are maybe 100, 150 millimeters thick, and obviously a lot that are thinner than that. But this is quite representative, this distance, although this is just a test coupon. So as a whole, it's much smaller. But the thickness, the dimension over which we're propagating the sound is actually quite comparable to that found in a lot of
representative test structures. So this thing here that you see in front of you is a test coupon, and we're making a measurement at the moment before we've fatigued the sample. But you can just about see it's in a dog bone form, and what's about to happen is that's going to go into a test machine and to be fatigued. And then periodically during, as it's fatigued, so it's, that means we're loading it, unloading it, loading it, unloading it over and over again, we're going to bring it back to the lab and make this measurement again. And hopefully it's part of a big program to see if we can track the aging of the sample over its life.
So how would you go about actually deforming it? I mean, presumably that would need a heck of a lot of force applied.
Yeah, it goes into a huge test machine, a huge hydraulic test machine in the basement of this building. But it's quite routine stuff, you know, fatigue testing materials. Mm-hmm. So there's some technicians that help us set that up and do that experiment. So it's eminently possible.
and is there a way of doing it during the actual fatigue? Because you said you would take it downstairs and then bring it back up, test it again. Is there any way of doing it dynamically in the moment when it's being fatigued?
It's something we'd very much like to do, and that's kind of probably one of the next steps of the work, which we talked a little bit about earlier, about permanently installing these sensors into structures and monitoring them. If you do that, you can get a lot more information potentially about the structure. You can look at the changes in the signal here, and those changes, it's basically much easier to measure a small change in a signal in a well set up experiment than it is if I, as you say, if I take this all apart, put this sample in the big testing machine, test it, and then bring it back to lab, assemble my experiment again. There's always going to be some small errors in going from that, assembling it, disassembling it, putting it all back together. So if we could monitor it continuously, it would be fantastic. At the moment, we can't quite do that. So we're not there yet, but come back in a year's time and we'll hopefully have done that.
So you think maybe that's the kind of timescale we're talking about, in a year or so?
Yeah, these experiments are actually, you know, at the moment going very, very well. So we've presented them at a number of conferences and to various of our people we work with in the industry, and it's attracted a lot of interest. It's one of the few viable ways that are out there at the moment where you can measure how structures age before they start to crack, which has been something that this whole field of non-destructive testing has been trying to do many tens of years of its existence, probably 100 years of existence as a field. And we've got some of the best measurements of that, so it's pretty exciting possibilities. So I think, yeah, I mean, it'll be the first results in a year's time, but I think it is over that length of time that we're going to be making real progress.
Thanks again to Bruce for taking the time out to chat and show me around his lab. Now, Physics World is published by the Institute of Physics' publishing arm, IOP Publishing. One of the company's other activities is to manage the peer review process and publish academic journals across a range of physics and related subjects. One of the latest big developments in the company is the launch of three new open access titles, JPhys Energy, JPhys Materials, and JPhys Photonics. I recently caught up with the publisher, Daniel Jopling, to find out why these new journals will be important for society as well as science.
So Dan, we're colleagues here at IOP Publishing, but while I sit over in the corner with the journalism team, you're with the larger academic journals group. Do you want to just sort of explain briefly what it is you do here?
Yeah, sure. So I'm the publisher of three brand new open access journals here at IOP Publishing. I say brand new, they've just launched, just opened for submissions as of a few weeks ago. And they are JPhys Energy, JPhys Materials, and JPhys Photonics. It's been quite a busy time in the lead up to launching these journals, as you can imagine, defining the scope and vision of the journals, working out practical requirements, or building the submission sites where authors will be able to submit their work, appointing editors and editorial board members who are really the eyes and ears of the journals within the communities that they serve. And just recently I've started going to conferences to help to promote the journals within their different communities.
So yes, it sounds like a busy time for you then, even though it's summer. And what is the thinking behind these journals? You know, what are they? Do you want to perhaps say a bit more about each one individually?
Yeah. So the thing the journals have in common is the JAFE is part of their name. They're an extension of IOP's Journal of Physics series, hence JAFIS. And that series has been publishing high quality research for over 50 years now. I'd say that the difference is, the difference between the existing series and these new titles is that these titles aim to showcase the most significant and exciting developments, and not just in physics, but expanding beyond that. We see research is increasingly interdisciplinary, at least in my experience of talking to the research community. This is something I hear very often, that research is becoming increasingly collaborative, enterprise breaking traditional subject boundaries. We see more and more researchers are experiencing the benefits of working collaboratively and adopting the techniques of other disciplines in their work. And we feel that communication and dissemination of that research should also evolve in order to reflect that. The journals are also open access, fully open access. So once published, all work is freely accessible by all, any place, at any time.
So the journals, then, you said there's lots of different disciplines involved and it's often interdisciplinary. So what scientific fields are actually covered in these three journals?
Okay, well, the clue's in the name, obviously, but the broad scope journals, coverage extending across all respective areas of energy, material science and photonics. And we really hope that the journals will serve as venues for high impact research and facilitate the flow and exchange of knowledge across existing and emerging communities within physics, chemistry, material science and related fields. So in energy, just to give you a little flavour, topics range from batteries and supercapacitors right through to fuel cells, hydrogen storage, solar energy conversion, photovoltaics and the smart grid. Materials, these lists aren't exhaustive, but just give you a flavour, biological and biomaterials, 2D materials such as graphene, nanomaterials, soft matter, semiconductors and magnetic and data storage materials. And in photonics, we cover fundamentals, properties, right through to the application of photonics, networks, processing, photonic communications, quantum optics, biophotonics, medical optics, and so on.
So you're saying now, you know, you've got like the battery research and graphene, you know, these are things that are quite well known, perhaps even beyond the sort of traditional science community. So does that reflect the fact that these fields are very important right now for society?
I think so, yeah. I think stripping it right back, I think basic, whether it be basic or applied research, these fields are really helping to shape the future of our planet in one way or another, be it through enabling us to live more sustainably by facilitating technological innovation or improving our quality of life or our safety. In energy, for instance, as we know, global warming as a result of human-induced climate change poses a clear threat to mankind, to humankind and to the planet. And a key means of addressing this is to develop and implement cleaner, more sustainable ways of generating, storing and transmitting energy. Materials, sorry, they sound quite profound or extremely basic, but they are the underpinning of everything around us. Mm-hmm. And creating new materials or enhancing or developing the properties, be it mechanical, chemical, electrical or so on, can help to deliver stronger, cheaper or lighter, more functional materials and help to contribute to a more sustainable world.
I guess that
the way we live.
I guess that would overlap then, wouldn't it? You know, the themes there and the topics, like the energy technologies, that would overlap with materials, I assume. And I mean, is the fact that these areas and these scientific investigations they're covering are so important, does that sort of feed into the fact that this is an open access journal? Was that part of the thinking behind that?
I think, in terms of being interdisciplinary and linking different communities, open access can certainly help in that it ensures maximum visibility and accessibility of research papers. So as I say, open access means that once a paper is published, it's not behind a paywall, it's free for anyone anywhere in the world to access in perpetuity.
Is that kind of the main reason it's in open access?
One of the key drivers in being open access is that increasingly, well, there's a big movement for open science generally and open access in particular across different research communities and different geographical regions. Some researchers are being mandated to publish their work open access, and IOP has a commitment to ensuring that authors can do that.
So you hear as well this term open science, and to me it sort of seems to mean different things to different people, and it covers much more than just open access. You know, it's the challenges with sharing large amounts of scientific data and making sense of that and the actual process of science. I mean, what do you understand by that term, open science?
Yeah, it can be quite nebulous, I suppose. I think what connects the various strands, whether it's open access, open data, open code, or open peer review, what ties them all together is the idea of making scientific research, the processes behind it, so the methodologies involved in the research, as well as the process of publishing that research and making the outcomes known, so peer review, publishing it and making it as widely accessible, is all about accessibility and increasing the transparency of research to enhance the reproducibility of work. Just to try and accelerate and expedite the communication of knowledge to as many people as possible. So there's open access, as you say, that's one angle. Citizen science, I know you spoke to Chris Lintott.
That's right, yeah, that was a few weeks ago now.
Recently, yeah, which is a really nice piece. He's far better placed to talk about citizen science than I am.
Yeah.
Also, open data is a huge issue within publishing in the scientific community at the moment. So the idea here is to enhance reproducibility, movements encouraging researchers to share the data behind their research papers, their research outcomes, which can enhance reproducibility.
So I imagine there's whole huge kind of IT projects that need to sort of be in place to facilitate that. You know, it's a sort of a nice philosophy, but you know, there's lots of challenges in actually making it a reality.
Oh, hugely, yeah. Yeah, I think the infrastructure has to be developed and has to be put in place. So it comes from policies, the coordination, development of new tools, and as you say, new resources, because if we want to share data and think about how we curate it and how people might want to use it, there needs to be a lot of thought rather than just putting it up online and, you know, seeing what happens. It needs to be really quite carefully considered. And same with code as well, and not just data but code, and making sure that researchers get the recognition they deserve, which always perhaps hasn't always been the case in research papers, and the way that research is evaluated is typically focused around research outcomes in the form of a paper, but there might be a lot of code and software that underlies the research. How do we make that more visible as well and ensure that researchers can gain recognition for that? And by making it open source in repositories, that can then also help to accelerate discoveries in the future.
Great, it's a highly active time then. So, I mean, finally, how would somebody listening to this, if they wanted to access those papers from the three journals, or if they wanted to even submit a paper, how would they go about that?
Yep, you can see online, I think you're going to provide the links next to this interview, James, for the homepages of the journals.
Yes, that'll be on the Physics World website. Yeah, there'll be an article there.
Excellent. And as we say, we're now open for submissions. The first 50 accepted papers to each journal will receive a full waiver of the article processing charge, which means they'll be published completely free of charge and on an open access basis.
Well, thanks, Dan, for appearing on the podcast. And I'll share links to the three new journals on the audio pages of the Physics World website. Next week, we'll be back to business as usual, as Hamish Johnston will be joined by some of the other Physics World journalists to discuss the week's latest developments. We hope you join us then. Bye. Physics World.